Okay, so this morning I wanted to spend some time speaking about Rav Moshe Feinstein in particular. It's a heavy task to speak about Rav Moshe in particular because most people are probably familiar with him, and everyone's heard some story about him, about his greenness. He was most likely one of the most, if not the most important rabbis in the 20th century. The reason why was because of his influence. His influence spread way beyond one single community. In fact, within his own community, he might have even had less of an influence in comparison to the influence that he had around the country and really even around the world. And his influence continues to spread to this day. We'll divide our shir as we normally do into two parts. Maybe Rav Moshe will have a bit more of an emphasis on his Torah, but we'll begin with a biographical information about him and his early life, in particular the last 40 or 50 years of his life. That's where much of the Torah that we have nowadays comes from. So we'll spend some time on that as well. And then the rest of it, we'll just be discussing his Torah and going through a few important tshuvas. As in case you're not familiar already, Rav Moshe is most well known for his contribution to the world of halacha. He contributed more than arguably any other rabbi in modern history in terms of helping us understand how halacha works and how we should define halacha for ourselves. The 20th century was certainly a time in which many new technologies and many new innovations were brought into the world, and no one, frankly, other than Rav Moshe Feinstein could have solved the questions and could have, at the very least, began and finished the discussion about so many of the new technological advances that the world has. So without him, honestly, it's unclear where Orthodox Judaism would be nowadays. Other than discussing his Torah contributions to the world, it goes without saying, so other than the fact that Rav Moshe Feinstein was an absolute Gaon Olam, he was an absolute genius, his perspective and perception of how the Torah worked and how halacha l'maaseh should be developed was unprecedented, and it was absolutely amazing, his halacha contributions. But other than the fact that he was an amazing halachist, an amazing teacher of Torah, he was also probably most well known, or at least equally well known, for his absolute amazing midos and the kindness that he had for other people, the love that he had for other people. There's so many stories that talk about the greatness that he has and who he was, not at all relating to the specific Torah that he taught, but just because of the person that he is in particular. One story that sticks out in my mind is the story that it's almost hard to believe, but they always, as they say, with all these stories, even if they're not true, they don't say them about any of us, and so it was said about Rav Moshe. So again, even if it's not true, it's still amazing. But if you learn about him, it's actually not so hard to believe that it would be true. And the story goes as follows, that one time, in his older years, he was with someone, and someone called a taxi for him, and Rav Moshe got into the car, and the lovely gentleman that he was with, he decided to close the door behind him, as he would respectfully for the rabbi, and then about a block, the car drives away. About a block later, Rav Moshe asks the taxi driver to please stop. He says, okay, I guess I'll stop, I don't know why, but I'm going to stop. And he opens the door, and it turns out Rav Moshe's finger was stuck in the door for an entire block, and the reason why he didn't want to open the door back there when the guy closed the door because he didn't want to make the person feel bad for doing such a thing. Obviously, it wasn't intentional, but he didn't want to embarrass him or make him feel bad. And again, it's a crazy hard story to believe anyone who has ever closed the door on their finger. I have closed it on my finger. It is incredibly painful. And so it's hard to imagine that anyone would have the ability to withstand that pain. But again, if anyone would have such midos and such an incredible ability to not want to embarrass someone, it would be Rav Moshe. So that is a story that does come to mind. So he is known for these two things. Number one, a purveyor of halacha and a teacher of halacha, unlike we have seen in recent years and in the past millennia, perhaps even. And number two, the absolute most kindest individual that you would ever interact with, and someone truly who was enhanced by his Torah to such an extent that he just loved every single individual and every single person. So let's begin. Moshe Feinstein was born on the 7th of Adar in 5655. That's March 3rd, 1865. He was born in a town called Uzda. Am I saying that right? Uzda, yeah, Uzda. Uzda in Russia. He was named Moshe. Anyone know why he got the name Moshe?
His birthday.
Oh, good. He was born on the 7th of Adar, like we just said. And on the 7th of Adar, that's when Moshe Rabbeinu was born. And Moshe Rabbeinu was also passed away. And that's why his family decided to name him Moshe, because after the great Moshe Rabbeinu. His parents, their names were Rabbi David Feinstein and Rebbetzin Faye Gittel. His father was the rabbi of the town of Uzda when Rav Moshe was born. Rav Moshe wrote many svarim, and we'll spend some time speaking about in particular, his Igros Moshe, which is all of his tshuvos. But take a look at source number one for just a moment. It's an excerpt from an English translation of his introduction to one of his svarim called Dibros Moshe, a sefer that we'll speak about a little bit later. And in his introduction to this sefer, he talks about his father. Who was his father? He says in source number one, he was a great gaon, a tzaddik, a chassid, and anav. There was hardly a likeness to him in midos and in the performance of every deed for heaven's sake alone, as well as his love of Torah and those who study it, and in his love for every Jew. He learned more than two sudarim of Gemara with me and my holy brothers of blessed memory, and a large portion of Choshei Mishpat. Elsewhere, Rav Moshe wrote, I lived near his town, and as long as he lived, I consulted him in all complicated halakha questions. His responses were as if from Sinai itself. So clearly, Rav Moshe had a tremendous respect for his father. His father actually will speak about this also in a little bit, but his father passes away just around the time that Rav Moshe ends up moving to America. If you just take a quick look at what we just read, clearly the way Rav Moshe is describing his father, it's also probably how we would describe Rav Moshe himself. So it's clear that Rav Moshe really followed in the ways of his father in terms of his Torah teaching and also his kindness and his anava, his humility. These are all attributes that he learned from his father. Rav Moshe's mother was also an incredible influence for him. Take a look at source number two. He writes as follows: she had no peer in fear of Hashem and love of Torah. All she aspired for was that we become great in Torah. She expended every effort in seeing that we not waste any time at all from our learning. Stories talk about the fact that the Feinstein family were always encouraging their kids to learn Torah. You're right, one does not just become Rav Moshe Feinstein overnight, and clearly it's because of the incredible influence that his family and his parents in particular had on him, and the Hakaras HaTov, the absolute thankfulness that Rav Moshe had for his parents his entire life was so clear, because he realized that it was because of them that he was able to develop into the person that he was. When Rav Moshe was born, it was not only just a very exciting event, like anyone would be excited with the fact that a child was born, but as we just saw, Rav Moshe, I mean, this was later, but he had lost brothers, and before he was even born, his mother had a number of miscarriages. So the fact that he was born healthily and everything was okay, that was a tremendous simcha for the entire family. As a child, Rav Moshe really was one of these people who you would call an Eloi. He was special in so many ways. He was clearly just a very intelligent boy from a very, very young age. He was also an incredibly sweet boy from a very young age. Again, these two qualities of himself that will continue throughout his entire life. Just a very fascinating, interesting story. When he was at the age of 8, he gave up the game of chess. So in other words, before 8, for the first 8 years of his life, he loved playing chess. It's something that was common in those days, in particular for people who learn Torah. A nice way to take a break was to learn chess, because it also keeps the mind working, but it's also a little bit of fun. But at the age of 8, he decided to give up chess, and there are two reasons that he was quoted as to why he gave up chess. Number one, this is the age of 8. He said, I told myself that if one is already using his mind, it should be better used for studying Torah. That was one reason. And again, the other reason, he says, he did not like any game in which there is a winner and a loser, because he always felt bad for the loser. These two qualities will, again, continue to be a common theme in his life, his love for everyone and his absolute love of Torah. Okay, so in 1907, when Rav Moshe Feinstein was 12, his family moved to the town of Starobin, where Rav Moshe's father became a Rav of this town. Rav Moshe at this point went to the town of Slutsk. That is where he learned in a yeshiva called Eitz Chaim, and he learned under the famed Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer. Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer is also one of the great Gedolim of yesteryear, of the last 150 years or so. At this point, he became very close with Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer's son-in-law, who was Rav Aaron Cutler. Who was Rav Aaron Cutler?
Lakewood.
Right, he's the one who founded BMG in Lakewood, so he knew lots of Torah people in his young age, and it was clear that these relationships that he built, even in this time, continued to be an important.
Sorry?
Oh, really? Oh, okay, cool. Very young. So maybe, did you know him too?
I know.
You know him
well.
Too. You were a motion of our own color. We're all just hanging out there.
Actually, so he went to Lakewood many years ago. And she met one of the rabbits and she was from France.
Yeah.
And she said she remembers the fish family from Europe.
Yeah. Okay. Not bad. Okay. So maybe, all right. So again, all these relationships that Rav Moshe had were very important for later in his life. These relationships that he built in these very young years with some of these rabbis who had all become these great gedolim were very important to him. In 1910, at the age of 15, Rav Pesach Pruskin, who was the mashkiach in the yeshiva that Rav Moshe was learning in, and he was the mashkiach in the yeshiva of Eitz Chaim, he decided to start his own yeshiva in the town of Shklov, and he chose a small elite cadre of young men to come start this yeshiva with him, and so Rav Moshe was chosen as one of those individuals. So Rav Moshe moved to this yeshiva in Shklov to learn under Rav Pesach Pruskin. The yeshiva shortly after ended up moving to a town of Amstislav, and Rav Moshe ended up learning under Rav Pruskin for the next 4 years, so he was clearly an important Rav in Rav Moshe's life. Rav Moshe would refer to him as his Rebbe. It seems that he was probably one of the most important rabbis that he had developed a relationship with over his years. In 1912, when he was 17 years old, it was said of Rav Moshe that he had mastered all of Shas, which is, anyone who is not familiar with Shas is a lot of text and a lot of information, and so at the age of 17, to master Shas, and to master Shas for Rav Moshe means to know everything by heart. He knew it all by heart by the age of 17. He was able to quote anything Baal Peh. Again, we're not talking about someone who has just an average level of IQ. He was clearly a very, very intelligent individual, and clearly not everyone would have the ability to do that. By the age of 19, he had finished all of Shulchan Aruch Torah as well, and it was at these very early ages that he already began to sort of plant the seeds for the fact that he was going to become this great gadol who was going to be writing tshuvas and spreading halacha throughout the world. When he was 19, his father encouraged him to start writing down tshuvas and start responding to questions that were given. So he wrote his first tshuva when he was 19 years old, and it was some of these tshuvas that would ultimately be added to the Igros Moshe. People, there's a bit of a misnomer about how Igros Moshe works. It's not like Rav Moshe was writing Sfarim and he was always planning to write the Igros Moshe. No, Rav Moshe wrote thousands and thousands of tshuvas throughout his lifetime, and they were all compiled into these books and categorized according to the way of the Shulchan Aruch. I believe the tally right now is that there are 9 Igros Moshe volumes published, and 7 of them were published during his life, and all approved and read over by him. 2 of them are published posthumously and are slightly controversial because of the fact that Rav Moshe never got to review them a second time before they went into print. But anyways, he started writing his first tshuva at the age of 19. And when he was 19, so for those of us who are in high math, that was the year 1914. The year 1914 was also the outbreak of World War I. It was at this time that he decided to move back with his family for a short while. When he was with his family, where is his family now? In Starobin, right? That's where his father had moved after he was the Rav in Uzda. So when he was in this town, he gave shiurim to the local youth, and he was already teaching Torah at that age. In the year 1915, when Rav Moshe was 20 years old, Rav Moshe was asked to become the Rav in no other place other than Uzda, the town that his father was the Rav, and it was a certain sense of pride and very sentimental sentiments, but the fact that he was able to be back in the town where his father was a Rav so many years before, so he was the Rav there. While Rav Moshe was in Uzda, if you'll notice, we have not mentioned that Rav Moshe got married yet, because he was not married at this point. He was a single Rav at this time. When he was there, part of the contract package that he worked out with the community, was that there was a woman who would be there to help provide meals for him, right? Rav Moshe was talented at many things, but evidently cooking was not one of them, so he had a woman. So he had a woman in the community who would cook meals for him. Take a look at source number 3 on page 2. There's another famous story, but it, again, speaks to the greatness and the ultimate kindness of who Rav Moshe was. So it says as follows. One day, Rav Moshe's sister Chana arrived in Uzda to visit her brother. I see you are being treated very well, she commented upon seeing him. You've put on a little bit of weight. I am being treated well, Rav Moshe replied. The woman who cooks for me prepares a heaping plate of food for each meal. I always finish all that is served, not wanting her to think I find her food lacking. However, she sees my clean plate as a sign of hunger, and she promptly serves me seconds, which I also partake of for her sake. And so, yes, I have put on weight. Later that day, Chana joined him for a meal at the woman's house. She took one bite and found that it tasted so awful that she was tempted to spit it out. With a heaping plate of food staring at her and not wishing to insult her hostess, she saw no way out of her dilemma but to clear the food off the plate when the woman was not looking. So evidently this food was a horrible cook, probably one of the worst cooks in Uzda perhaps, but she was, maybe that's why no one else wanted to eat her food other than Rav Moshe. So she was cooking for him and he hated her food, but again, because of the ultimate great kindness of this, that this man had, he always ate her food every single day. He would eat it twice because he would have 2 heapings of it, and he never said anything to this woman. You imagine that I imagine there probably is a family out there that can trace their lineage back to this woman. So I wonder if when they read the book, when they saw this story, I wonder how they felt. But we'll imagine that it was a well-known story regardless, so they didn't find out in the book. When Rav Moshe was 25, he in the year 1920, he became a Rav in a town called Luban, which was a very special, very learned community. At the age of 26 in 1921, Rav Moshe fled from the town of Lublin just for a temporary time. The reason why he fled was because there was a pogrom that he had sensed was coming, and it turns out that it did come. There was even a bomb that was detonated in his house that he was living in. He, again, had already fled, so he was safe. While he was gone, he ended up spending 6 months away from this town in the house of Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer. He ended up, however, returning back to the town of Lublin, and he continued to be there until he ended up leaving Russia about 10 years later. In 1922, when he was 27 years old, that's when Rav Moshe finally got married. He married a woman by the name of Shima. Her father's name was Rabbi Yaakov Moshe Cohen Kasnowitz, so Shima Kasnowitz. He was the mohel and the shochet in the town of Lublin, and that's how he met her, and they had a beautiful marriage. We'll speak in just a few moments about the incredible marriage that Rav Moshe and his wife shared together, but the amazing sacrifices that each of them made for each other are absolutely historic, and we'll speak about them again in just a moment. They had five children together. Four of them were born in Russia, in this town of Lublin, and one of them was born in the U.S. The first child that was born, his name is Pesach Chaim. He ended up dying at a young age because of whooping cough, but they had three other children in Russia. They had Faigital, Shifra, and David. These were the children that were born there. Then Reuven was born in the U.S. Again, like we said a moment ago, the stories of the Mesiras Nefesh that each of them had for each other was amazing. One story in particular that comes to mind is a story that one time it was said that Rav Moshe was walking with his shamash into some big conference or something with a lot of great rabbis, I think, and he walks in, and the shamash says to Rav Moshe, you know, you probably want to go in through the back so that no one sees you, because they know it bothers you when, like, people stand up for you. He says, no, let's go through the front door so that everyone stands up for me. And the shamash is like, well, okay, I guess we'll do that. And so he went in, everyone stood up for him, and then afterwards, the shamash said, you know, Rebbe, that's not like you to be such a Baal Gaiva to want to do something like that. He said, no, but my wife was here, and she likes it when people give me that sort of kavod and honor, and because of all that she has given to allow me to reach this stature, she also deserves to see how people honor me because of it. And so even though he never would want such a thing, he did it because of his wife. Rav Moshe continued to live in Lublin until the age of 36. He had faced horrible oppression while he was there because of the developments in communist Russia. He was harassed constantly, and ultimately he decided that he had to leave in 1936 because of all the terrible things they were doing to him. One of the big things that they were doing in those times in Russia was that they were making sure to sort of attack rabbis to make them either leave the rabbinate, they would kill rabbis, they would do all these terrible things, charge them horrible taxes, and so that's why Rav Moshe ended up deciding to leave. In 1936, when Rav Moshe was 41, so he left Russia on the 5th of Elul. In 1937, so there, he was spent some time in transit, but finally in the year 1937, that's when Rav Moshe finally made it to America. It's interesting because when Rav Moshe got to America, he was known by many great Rabbanim because he had already built up a certain stature for himself in the Torah world, but most regular folk in America had never heard of him at that point. So when he arrived in New York at the docks, he was greeted by a crowd of great Rabbanim and Talmidei Chachamim, but no one else was there because no one knew who he was. When Rav Moshe first arrived in New York, it was a very difficult few months that he was there at the beginning, because he knew he had to come to America because it was the land of the free, and he knew that it was a country that would take care of him, but unfortunately, he didn't have any jobs or anything like that lined up. Finally, after some time, he was finally offered a job in the yeshiva of MTJ, Mesivta Teferis Yerushalayim. That's where he would end up staying for the rest of his life. For 49 years, he was there as the Rosh Yeshiva. Early months when he was the Rosh Yeshiva in MTJ, they were very difficult. Him and his wife struggled to find an apartment, and so he would. There are stories that go on that he would end up sleeping in the yeshiva. He would sleep on benches and only come home for Shabbos, and all these crazy stories. MTJ, I forgot to mention, was. Sorry? About to say. So MTJ is located on the Lower East Side. So ultimately, him and his wife ended up getting an apartment on the Lower East Side, and that's where they, again, spent the rest of their life. To clarify, so Rabbi Tendler ended up marrying Rosh's daughter, and they live in Muncie. So it was through the prism of this yeshiva that he ended up becoming the gadol that he was. It was sort of the perfect place for him. It happens to be, I don't want to spend too much time on this because it's not the most positive thing to say, but Rav Schechter from YU has said, I believe on a number of occasions, that Rav Moshe didn't have many star talmidim, right? There's not many people that there are a few and a strong handful of them, but he didn't have many. And so when he was teaching in his yeshiva, perhaps one can argue that he spent so much time, again, not chas shalom, he didn't take away that much time from his talmidim, but part of him being there was that he was able to use that time to work on his chuvos, and we'll see other svarim as well. At the age of 52, so we're skipping ahead a little bit, in the year 1947, that's when Rav Moshe published his first work. What was his first work? Anyone know? The Dibros Moshe. So Rav Moshe had two major sets of books. One was the Igros Moshe, which again we'll talk about in a little bit in a few more minutes. But the first one that he published was his Dibros Moshe. Even though he is most well known for his Igros Moshe, he was most proud of his Dibros Moshe. That is clearly much more what he spent most of his time on. The Igros Moshe were just like you. Again, someone, a genius like Ramosha, even though you read through his halacha tshuva with Yubet, someone that spent hours and hours on these things, he would spend like a few minutes here and there when he would have a chance. He was asked about like, can a person drink like chalav stam, which we'll speak about in a few minutes, and in 10 minutes he would write a tshuva together and he would know everything by heart, so he just wrote it all down. But his Dibros Moshe was something that he valued much more. It was a commentary that he wrote on Shas, on Gemara. He cherished and valued this set of svarim that he came out with so much that it was very clear that he spent an immense amount of time on it. In fact, if you look through the Dibros Moshe, which the Dibros Moshe is not learned even an iota close to how much the Igros Moshe is learned, it's said about the Dibros Moshe that it's just a very complex sefer, in particular because it's in this sefer where you truly see how incredibly smart Rav Moshe was. You need like hours to analyze each piece because they're so complicated and they're so back and forth, and he just knew everything so clearly, and everything was just laid out in his mind so clearly that, again, you have to be an absolute genius just to understand what he's talking about because it's just so complex. But again, this was what he spent most of his energy on, and this is what he cherished the most in terms of his published svarim. By the age of 64 in 1959, that's when he published his first volume of the Igros Moshe. In the year 1973, when he was 78 years old, that's when the Sefer Ma'aneh L'Igrot came out. Anyone has ever heard of the Sefer Ma'aneh L'Igrot? Anyone? Okay, the Sefer Ma'aneh L'Igrot is not a very famous sefer because it is had one task, and we'll read about it in just a second. The task of the author was to disprove every single thing that Rav Moshe had ever said. And it obviously became very not famous and not well-liked because of the fact that everyone liked Rav Moshe. So no one's going to like someone trying to disprove Rav Moshe. Take a look at source number 4 for a second. It's in Hebrew, but we'll translate it. We'll just read the first couple of lines. Or Shlomo Aviner, who is very famous for his SMS shailot, people text him in questions. So someone texted him the question, Maharav Omer al Hasefer Ma'aneh L'Igrot Shecholik al Shut Igros Moshe. What does the Rebbe think about this book, Ma'aneh L'Igrot, that just says terrible things about Rav Moshe and tries to disprove everything that he says? The Sefer came out before he died, yeah. This tshuva, I do not believe it came out before he died, though. Okay. I think, yes, but the book came out while he was still alive. So he says as follows, as to answer this question, Rav Avinia writes, Mutter l'talmid chacham l'chlok al hagan Rav Moshe Feinstein. He says, don't think that a person who is great in Torah learning and stature does not have the ability to argue in a Rav Moshe Feinstein. Clearly anyone is allowed to argue in a Rav Moshe Feinstein if they were knowledgeable enough. Again, good luck with that. But you are allowed to argue on him. Aval, he says, Ha-sefer hazeh kasuf besignon pogani v'chotzuf neged echad migaone olam. He says that the problem with this sefer was that it was specifically written to sort of bash one of the great and most important leading Torah scholars in the world. And as Migone Olam Gaon Betzadik, right? V'yish Lugno Sefer says, as a result, we should put this book into hiding. People very famously decided to burn the Ma'aneh L'Igrot. It was so unpopular because, again, it bashed Rav Moshe. And everyone loved Rav Moshe. You know, the fact that someone could stand up and say anything against him was a crazy thing. We'll speak about in just a moment who the author was, but let's keep reading a little bit more. Bismano HaMechaber Shalach is a Sefer La Stipler, right? This book was sent by the author, so the great Stipler Gaon. V'achar Kach Ba Elavin. So he came to him and he said, so Stipler, what do you think of my great book, Ma'aneh L'Igrot? HaStipler Nazaf Me'od. B'tza'ak Alav Al Shapega V'Ha'aliv Esagon Rav Moshe Feinstein. He started yelling at him, how dare you write such a disgusting book about one of the great rabbis of the world. V'zarku Mibeitu, and he threw him out of his house. Achar Kach Siper HaStipler Esadavar Livno HaGrach Kanievsky. Hosef Shagan Rav Moshe Feinstein who posek gadol v'tzadik. It was clear in so many worlds that Rav Moshe Feinstein was such an absolute gadol ador, such an absolute genius, someone who was clearly only trying to perpetuate the Masorah and the teachings of the Jewish tradition, and someone who was only trying to do good in this world. And the fact that he had someone standing up against him trying to bash him was a disgusting thing.
Well, he was considered the final opinion, the expert
Right. Okay, so who was the author of this book? So the author of the book was a Satmar Chassid. Anyone that knows anything about the history of Rav Moshe, which we'll speak about in a little bit, is that Rav Moshe had a very big run-in with the Satmar Rebbe, Rav Yoel Teitelbaum. We'll speak about that in just towards the end of this year, in just a few more minutes. But Satmar became very anti him, and as a result, this Satmar Chassid decided to write a book again to sort of support his Rebbe in his disagreement with Rav Moshe. Arguably, the Satmar Rebbe would not have appreciated this book as well, because you could have a respectful disagreement, but you can't decide to bash a great gadol. But again, that is who wrote the Sefer, and that's why it was written, because of the context of Satmar. By the time Rav Moshe was 83 years old in 1978, he had fallen very ill, and he would live for just a few more years. But in those final years, he would still keep teaching Torah, but Rav Moshe was very well known for the fact that he had a very rigorous schedule. He'd wake up super, super early in the morning, and he would be learning, and then he'd be teaching, and he'd be traveling, and he'd be all over the place. In these final years of his life, he decided to pull back a lot, because it was just not plausible for a man of his age to keep doing this. But he taught Torah till the end of his life. We'll speak about the end of his life in just a moment, but we're going to now divert to talk about the most well-known part of Rav Moshe's life, and that is the fact that he was this great halachic decider. So like we said, he had an amazing memory, a truly outstanding memory. He knew all of Shas, all of Poskim, he knew everything by heart. He was the Posek Hador, like Shari just said, he was the final word in anything. When he said something, you trusted him. The reason why Rav Moshe arguably became so famous among so many American households, even to those who probably couldn't even read a word that he ever wrote in Hebrew, is because of the fact that he was very lenient, right? And so it's very important to know about Rav Moshe that he was not lenient on everything. Very famously, Rav Moshe was not very into people listening to music at all. And the reason why he was not into people listening to music at all is because of the fact that the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed a couple of thousand years ago. And he said, how can a person be listening to music? However, Rav Moshe is not quoted for his chumras, his stringencies. He's usually only quoted for his leniencies, of which he had many. The statement and the fact that the person could give greater leniencies, again, is only showing of the great Talmid Chacham that they are. People think that a kula means that you're like some schlub, that you just want a leniency. But no, Rav Moshe found the leniencies because of his greatness in Torah, because of his ability to understand Torah on such a deep, intricate, and intimate level. But he was accepted universally in terms of his psak. Again, Satmar Rebbe, we'll speak about that in a minute. But other than that, every community, the modern Orthodox, Haredi, everyone accepted, appreciated who he was. There are stories said about how Rav Moshe knew everything by heart so well, and that was such a critical aspect of how he wrote his tshuvot, his halachic responses, such that when he was giving a shir, he would say that such and such, this prima gadim could be found on sifkatan gimel, whatever. He would say exactly where it was. And if someone in shir would say, Rebbe, you made a mistake, a certain kind of student to say that, Rebbe, you made a mistake, it's actually sifkatan dalet, not gimel. So at that point, if that would ever happen, which again was very rare, he would stop the entire shir and he would go look it up. And usually he was right that it was in that place. But the reason why he was so careful about this, to make sure that he was always right, was, God forbid, not out of a sense of gaiva or haughtiness, but because of the fact that that's how his entire system worked. He was asked so many different questions throughout the years, and he had to write tshuvas. And again, just his style was writing them so quickly that he needed to have this immediate recall of where everything was located in his mind. If he made a mistake, then the whole system would fall apart. He would have to start looking up in books and start, doing actual research, which again is not something that a man of his stature or lack of time would be able to afford. So that's why it was so critical. And again, he did really know everything by heart, and he did have this amazing recall. One other note about Rav Moshe's tshuvas was that Rav Shechter, very famously, again, and why he talks about how when he was studying for his smicha bechinas, he would do it very simply, like everyone does. He would open up a Negros Moshe and look at one of the shilas, he would look at one of the questions, and Rav Shachar said, would sit down and try to answer the question, just like Rav Moshe answered the question. So in other words, he'd look at the question, close the book, and then he'd start writing it himself. And Rav Shachar loves telling the story, that every single time he would write down the logical perpetuation of the sugya, he would write, you know, it starts with the chumash, the pasuk, the gemara, whatever, he'd write the entire thing down, and he would open it up, and he was always wrong. He always looked at Rav Moshe's shuvas, and he never got it right. Why? Because, again, the amazing expanse and knowledge of Torah that Rav Moshe had, he always was able to connect everything. He was famous for being able to connect one area of Torah to something absolutely sounding irrelevant to the regular layperson, but he would connect everything because he saw how there was a oneness to the Torah and how everything was magically, not magically, but truthfully really connected and interconnected with one another. So Rav Shechter would always feel a little bit bad because he realized that when he would write his tshuva at step four, Rav Moshe would go in an entirely, you know, unexpected and different direction and possibly in such a way, and Rav Shechter would, you know, again, anyone who knows Rav Shechter knows that Rav Shechter is a huge gadol hadorah, so this is not to minimize, God forbid, who he is, but it's just how he references himself in terms of comparing to this other gadol hadorah of Rav Moshe Feinstein. In 1975, so backtracking a little bit, in 1975, Rav Moshe was asked about his halachic response, his style. There was a famous article in the New York Times that was written about Rav Moshe Feinstein in terms of how he wrote his response. So take a look at source number 5 on page 3. The article writes as follows. Tradition has it that young rabbis completing their training are given an ordination certificate and the telephone number of Rav Moshe Feinstein. He is the closest that Orthodox Jewry comes to a court of last resort. During much of the day, he sits plumped atop a fat cushion, that's not the nicest way of saying that, in a chair in his study on the Lower East Side. Great volumes of religious law and opinion stacked from floor to ceiling behind him. His telephone in hand, a hotline, connects him with the yeshiva he heads who can tell how quickly followers there will need his counsel. His interpretations of religious law, like others written in the past millennium, are precedents guiding the faithful. About 2,000, okay, whatever, skips to the next paragraph, impressing the wise. Rabbi Feinstein is one of that select group who continue the tradition of deciding difficult issues. Born in Russia 80 years ago, he began rendering formal opinions at age 18. He came to this country in 1937, and his vernacular is still Russian-dabbed Yiddish. Short, spry, richly bearded, he has reached the heights of religious jurisprudence not by appointment or election, but by recognition of his talents. Rav Moshe said, "You can't wake up in the morning and decide you're an expert on answers," he said. Recently, as disciples clustered around him, if people see that one answer is good and another answer is good, gradually you'll be accepted. Right? Clearly, Rav Moshe is being absolutely humble here in terms of his greatness. Many questions come from other rabbis, and his response have been published in Hebrew in 5 large volumes. At that point, there's only 5 volumes called Negros Moshe. At least one rabbi has devoted a huge time to attacking his views, and the Hasidic Samar Jews in New York plastered up handbills of defiance when one of Rabbi Feinstein's responses legitimized artificial insemination. Again, we'll get to that in just a few moments. A rabbi who replies to people's questions works harder than a doctor dealing with a case of life and death, Rabbi Feinstein said. The doctor is responsible only to his patient, but the rabbi is responsible to God. So Rav Moshe clearly took his tshuva writing seriously, and he clearly also viewed himself in a very humble way. He's just like, I don't know, people started writing me questions, so I decided to answer the questions, and then they liked the answers, so then I just kept writing the answers. You know, so he wasn't someone who bragged or was gaivadig about the greatness of who he was. Okay, so let's turn a little bit to talk about now Rav Moshe's Igros Moshe. So again, right now we're up to 9 volumes of the Igros Moshe. I want to spend just a few moments reading through his introduction. Again, it's in Hebrew, but we'll translate it line by line. We'll only read about the first paragraph and a half or so. But just to get a sense of how Rav Moshe, again, referred to himself and saw his halachic literature that he published. So source number 6, page 5. This is the introduction to Igros Moshe. Hine sifri ze shirobo hu mashi shavti He says, in this book that I have written before you, you know what it is? It's just like a bunch of answers that I jotted down based on some questions that I got. He says, even though the truth is, you know, maybe I shouldn't have written these answers, because there are lots of great rabbis out there who are filled with knowledge and fear of God, who also did not write down their own halakhic answers, right? So Rav Moshe says very simply, there are so many great rabbis out there that did not write tshuva, so who in the world am I to write these tshuvas down? He quotes a Gemara, Mimama Rabbi Abba, Amar Rav Huna, Amar Rav Besota, Daf Chaf Beis, Rabim Chalalim Hefila Zetam and Chacham Shalom Higia Lo Ra Umore. Right, so there are a few different types of Talmidei Chachamim. One is someone who can reach the point of teaching halacha. V'avsha Amar Gam V'asim Kol Harugeha Zetam and Chacham Shehigia Lo Ra Ve'in Umore. Right, so there are Talmidei Chachamim who can teach halacha and Talmidei Chachamim who cannot really teach halacha or who don't teach halacha. Mitam Zeh Kasav Rabbi Akiva Eger. So Rabbi Akiva Eger, one of the great Gedolim of yesteryear as well. Huva Be'akdamas Benav L'Sefer Hatshuvot Shelo. He writes in his introduction to one of his books, V'dai Asher Utsrachti L'Hashiv L'Sholi Midaga Shekol Ayeh Bechlal Kol Mi Sheyigia L'Ora Be'ino Mora Ayansham. So he talks about the fact that Rabbi Akiva Eger, when he wrote these tshuvot, when he wrote the introduction for these tshuvot, he said, you know, I'm teaching them, but don't take every last word that I'm writing totally at face value. He says, you know what, take it as knowledgeable Torah insight, but okay, you can maybe paskin differently if you see it in a different way. Right? With absolute humility, that's how Rabbi Akiva Eger wrote as well. Mikol makom elu shenimnu hu me'achar shegam ata tzarech hamora lohorot ka'amisus adin kamo shehaya tzarech lohoros bimei rav huna v'rabbi abba. He says, but there is a problem, however, because someone has to write tshuvas, someone has to give answers to questions. It can't be that the Jews are just left with not knowing the answer. So someone has to write like the rabbis in the Gemara did. Lachin af shevade b'chol dor hu mida acheres l'hachshiv higia l'horash arei rak chachme dor zeshayach sheyuru ata. He says, and in every single generation, you can't compare yourself to the great rabbis of the Gemara. You have to compare yourself to the great rabbis of the time, and you have to determine who the greatest rabbi is. Baleim hu hatzivoy l'horos l'doram, and whoever the greatest rabbi is, that's the one who has to give the answers to the questions. Zaha iyashar l'hasig b'dorot ha'achronim Mori Hora Kedoros Harishim, because you're never going to have a rabbi in 2019 like a rabbi in 2,000 years ago. So whoever the best rabbi of the time is, he's going to be the one who's going to write the answers. Well, Korchach Kavanas Ma'amaram Ze Tamichacham Shagiyo Lohora Inu Rak Al Ilu Shagiyo Lohora Bezmanam Dafka Al Af Ilu Shagiyo Lohora Bedoros Ilu Shemuchayv Mahoros Kedohora Rabbi Akiva Eger. Again, he's explaining how this idea that only the greatest rabbi of the time can answer questions. We don't wait for a rabbi like Rav Huna from the time of the Gemara to come around in 2019 to answer questions. We wait for the greatest rabbi of our time. Mekom makom. Nonetheless, he writes, Yesh vaday al kol echad lachush shema einu mechavin kaemes. He says, okay, so now he's going to turn back to himself. There's a concern that people have to have. Maybe what some great rabbi wrote is not true. Maybe what I'm writing, says Ramosh, maybe it's not true. V'lachin mitzat ha'yira hichriu she'in yichulim l'chavina misus ha'din ve'in lahem l'horos v'shani Rabbi Akiva Eger sha'af achar kol ha'chashashos hora v'hishib l'maaseh mitzat machir shalav midin higia l'ora d'rav guvre v'haya yichul l'amor atzmo. Again, it's continuing in the same theme, explaining how you need to be afraid, make sure you're writing the right thing, making sure you're getting the right answers, making sure you're getting the right rabbi to answer the questions. And then he continues, we'll just read a little bit more. But in Cain, Kol Shekin Laktani, Erech Kamoni. Certainly, Rav Moshe says, when someone like me is going to write some things down, She'ein bi Torah v'chachma kara'oi. He says, I'm not smart enough. I don't have any Torah, really. Shayali limnoam el haros legamrei. I am no one to be teaching Torah, says Rav Moshe Feinstein. V'kol shekini l'halos al ha'dufus u k'orah l'chol alam. And certainly I shouldn't be writing books published to people to give people halach decisions. That's crazy, he says. Aval. He says, however, I am aware that the rabbis of the time do have to be the ones to publish questions, even if they're not as great as Bedoros Chachmei Hagmar, even if they're not as great as Rav Huna, so some rabbis have to do it. So he says, I'm going to do it. Sheish vaday lachush ulay lo kivnu amisus hadin kfi shehu ames klafei shemaya aval ames lahora kavar neamar lo bashemayim. He says, however, even though I'm not like the great rabbis of the Gemara, and I am fearful of this, nonetheless, I am going to publish something, because at the end of the day, the Torah does not live in the heavens, it lives on earth. And someone on earth has to answer it. So I'm just going to try the best to do the best that I can. So I'm going to try the best I can, and I'm going to do whatever I can, and we'll read one more line. Al kazeh ne'amar shegam dvarav divrei Elokim Chaim. Says, at the end of the day, if you try your hardest, so that's going to be considered God's word as well. Me'achar shalon yira ha'pirish kamosha pasak, lo ya stir ledvarav. As long as someone's not going to say something absolutely crazy and contradictory, then we'll allow him to pask in halacha. So he says, again, about himself, I'm no one, I'm nothing, I know no Torah. However, someone's got to do it. So here is the Torah, and that is the introduction, how he introduces all of his responsa, and again, we as an international Orthodox community continue to follow his words. So clearly, this speaks to the absolute humility that he had. There's a little more, but we'll skip it. If anyone does want to read or is interested in reading it privately, I'm happy to do so. But let's keep going. So there are two important shuvas that I want to bring up that were very defining in the life of Rav Moshe Feinstein. One is his shuva on chalav stam. Can a person drink and partake of dairy products that are not made by Jews? Is that cake dairy? Is the cake dairy?
Yes.
Yeah? Okay, so how in the world are we allowed to be eating this cake that we have right in front of us because it's dairy, which means we assume there are some dairy products in there, and it doesn't always mean that, but we'll assume for now that this has dairy products in it. So how can we have this cake that was probably prepared by non-Jewish individuals? Why are we allowed to eat it? Because the Gemara says we cannot have milk made from non-Jews. It's a straight out Gemara. It's not like some crazy chumrah that one rabbi came up with once. The Gemara says you cannot have chalav stam. You cannot be drinking milk of non-Jews. And the concern of drinking milk of non-Jews is not like, you know, people, unfortunately, in the modern world that we live in, sometimes laugh at the, you keep like, you know, you only have Bishul Yisrael, you only have food cooked by Jews or whatever. But someone get that? I'll get it. All right, so since the Gemara says it, and the Gemara explains the reason why this is prohibited, is because there's a concern that non-Jews might mix in treif milk product. In other words, cows are not the only animals that have milk. Pigs could have milk also. So what's to stop someone from saying, putting a little pig milk in there, for example? That's one. Sorry? Okay. Do you only have milk with hashkacha?
I don't know.
Okay, good. So, okay, great. Okay, so.
Were you also worried about if there was a small bakery, the Jewish person buying the bread would start dating? Hang out.
Right. Okay, good. So there are two prohibitions here, and I don't want to confuse the two. There is the notion of bishul akum, of having food cooked by non-Jews, and that's one area of prohibition. But then there is chalav akum, having milk of non-Jews, and that is totally prohibited. The reason why milk of non-Jews is totally prohibited is because of the fact that that there is this concern of mixing in these unkosher ingredients. However, came along Rav Moshe with his great koach teheter, with his great ability to be matir things, and he said, you know what? It actually is okay, and I'll tell you why. Take a look on page number 7. This is his famous shuvah. We'll just read a few parts of it. He says, and this is a very in true Rav Moshe fashion. Can anyone read the title of the shuvah on the right side? Be'inyan Chalav? Anyone know that word?
Ha-companies.
Right, Rav Moshe, this is a very important thing to know about him. He was famous for the fact that when he did not know a Hebrew word or didn't care to know a Hebrew word or there was no Hebrew word for it, he would just write the Hebrew word, the English word in Hebrew with Hebrew letters. So regarding the milk that is made by the companies in America, can a person have any milk made by some great company? So he writes as follows. Ubedavar ha-chalav, if it's too small, then just feel free to listen outside. Ubedavar ha-chalav, shall ha-companies b'medinatino asher yishpik. He says, when it comes to the American companies, again, he's only talking about America. A person should not think they can go to any random country in the world and just take any milk, but so only in America. You see some milk on the shelf, and he says, these companies, they're terrified of the government. Why? Because if they mix another impure ingredient with this milk, they're going to be fined by the government. And the government will close down their business. Shalahem. They're going to be so terrified of mixing in anything else because the government says you have to have consistent standards, and one of those standards is that you cannot mix the milk of this animal with this animal. Therefore, if you are selling your milk as cow's milk, that means it has to be 100% cow's milk. It cannot be half cow and half pig milk. He says, therefore, yish tam gadol latir af belo shita haprach mishum da ikar diyadiyah berura hu kiriyah mamash kahadashuos. There's a Gemara that talks about the fact that even if we can't see something, but we can know it, then it seemingly will be okay. In this case, we can't see where each and every one of us, we're not going to the milk factories and seeing how they're preparing it. Nonetheless, any company in America, since there are standards developed by the American government about how milk is produced, therefore any milk of a non-Jewish person is going to be kosher without a hashgacha, without any sort of certification, as long as it is produced in America, because that's how the American government works. And he writes, look at the left side now, the bottom paragraph on the left side. The milk that is prohibited just because it's non-Jewish milk. It's totally okay for a Jewish person to partake of non-Jewish milk. Harucha shel kama alafim, v'memshal meshkach hasalem, hu vada yadiyah brura shehi kariyah shelo haya b'chal yisurim. Because the other companies who are producing milk are so concerned that they're going to be fined thousands of dollars for making even an accidental mistake like this, therefore we can assume that it's all kosher and all okay. He says, however, no reason to not hold like this. If a person wants to be lenient on this, totally okay. He does say, if you want to be lenient. Never should a person say that anyone who does this is not doing the right thing. Aval. He was machmir, and he said that people do have the right to say that I only want to eat challah Yisrael. That's that people should, if again, someone who's on the level to do it is allowed to. A person should not think, right? Sometimes there's a concern that if a person, people think that they could just take on any chumrah they want whenever they want. That's not how the world works. It's not how Judaism works. You can only take on a chumrah if there's no concern of what we call yuhura, if it's not going to look like you're being a baal gaiva, right? So let's say someone decides to take on this chumrah of only eating challah Yisrael. He says that's permissible. You don't have to be concerned of being a baal gaiva. And very famously, Rav Moshe himself was only accustomed to lahachmir la'atzmi, to only eat chalav Yisrael, he would not have chalav stam. Aval nisha rotza lakel, but if you want to be lenient, who osek kadina ve'in lahachshiva k'mezalzal b'Yisrael, a person should not think that you are a sinner. And it was from this that all Jews were allowed to eat Entenmann's, were allowed to eat Hershey's, are allowed to go into any American supermarket and grab a bottle of milk without a hashkacha is totally permissible. The reason why is because our Moshe permitted it in this tshuva. So again, most of the milk that we have nowadays has hashkacha. Why does it have hashkacha? It doesn't really need hashkacha. It's the same reason why your toilet paper has hashkacha, right? It's all the same thing. It has it because it has it, but it doesn't need it. Now, this does not change the fact that the problem with the culture that we have nowadays is that people think if I'm upstate New York somewhere and I see like a random farm, you can't just like go up to that farm and go to their little shop and go to their little milk stand and take a cup of their milk that they milk there. That would be totally prohibited. The only time you're allowed to have chalav akum is when it is produced by the companies in America. Right, if you were there like, yeah, with them milking it, then okay, fine. Which, if you were, yeah.
But the thing is, by him saying that,
no, what he said, and he framed it exactly how it is. He said this is a leniency. Right. The Gemara still says not to do it. We are allowed to do it and quote unquote go against the Gemara because of the fact that the reality of the world is just different than it used to be. So at the end of the day, you can do it, but I'm not going to do it because I'm choosing to do the absolute ideal.
You
know, it's okay to not do it.
I
understand what you're saying.
Somebody, you know, you could do this, but I don't do this because this is like I'm more masculine than you.
Yeah.
It sort of denigrates the leniency.
Okay. All right, do you have...
I mean, it's just like the same thing when people buy a slogan, you know. An Esrog is an Esrog, but no, they have to inspect it with a microscope because they have to be super masculine.
Those are very different things. People who do it with a microscope, I don't understand why they do that. That's not what the halacha says. He's saying the halacha is very clear. You can be lenient over here, but understand that it's a leniency. I am going to keep the machmir opinion, but understand that what you're doing is technically okay.
Why didn't he just say it's a leniency and you can do it?
In other words, you're saying like it's just like a slap in the face. Either matzir it and say it's totally okay, but don't make me feel bad at the end.
It's just like when I call you okay. Like you have bad spices.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I said,
give your own personal.
So they go, no, but it's better if it does. I'm like, but why? If it's okay to use it without an extra, it's better to
it's like if you ever use
getting paid to put the OU on it, that's why you want me to use it with the OU.
It's like if you ever use the CRC app or check on the CRC, nothing is ever like okay or not okay. It's like recommended or not recommended. Yeah, I hear what you're saying.
So I just feel like
it's a fair point. I hear what you're saying.
It's not, you know.
Unfortunately, because politics comes into it. If there weren't politics and money involved in the country's world today, it would be easier to know whether we're halacha or not halacha.
Right.
We don't learn kashrus laws anymore to know whether you can buy rice without a heksher or pasta. I call the OU up because, you know, when I worked for William Sonoma, we used to get a lot of imported products and they didn't have hekshers. So what's the deal with pasta? As long as it's flour and water and not enriched, you don't need to have a heksher. You know, like when you travel and you have to go into a store and there's not OU products, you need to know what you can buy.
Right.
And they seem to not want to.
Yeah, okay, so I hear what you're saying. I agree with what you're saying. Realize that Rav Moshe was involved with a lot of this stuff before the great political world of the kashrus organizations. So he said what he said from his absolute pure place. And yeah, so maybe there has been some of a bit of a mess that's been created in the kashrus world, but at the end of the day, realize what he said was coming from this absolute pure place, and it's not like he was being like this annoying OU representative.
Yeah, but probably there is another reason for it as well, because we live in the area where it's a lot of high standard kashrus.
Available. Yeah.
When you go outside of the New York area, you go to the, let's say, Arkansas somewhere. Okay?
Yeah.
You may not find Halof Israel milk, but you may find another milk.
Right.
And if you have a little child, you have to feed.
Right. Also realize that it's a little unclear. You know, you'd have to ask Rav Moshe what he thinks about the fact that Halof Israel milk is two times as expensive as Halof Akum. Some poskim will end up saying that you shouldn't even support these people because they're trying to, you know, raise the price. So that's inappropriate in itself. If all else was equal, then, you know, it's a different story. But again, I don't want to spend too much time on this, but realize that this was one of Rav Moshe's very big leniencies that he gave. Okay, we'll do one more quick source, and then and then a couple more quick things, and then we'll finish up. Okay, so the other thing that we've been alluding to the entire shiur is his very famous opinion about artificial insemination. Source number 8 is an article in the RJJ Journal. If those of you who are not familiar with the RJJ Journals, there is a volume of about 50 or probably even more right now or so of books that have various articles on halacha. And so this is one such article on artificial insemination. So let's read as follows, source number 8. We'll read just a few of these pages. It says, a number of years ago, a great controversy erupted among leading rabbinic decisors. A dispute was generated a totally uncharacteristic outburst of infective heat and partisanship in the halachic world. Scholars all over the world were astounded at the sharp tone and bitter disagreements engendered by a point of law. For generally, the tone of rabbinic intercourse is elegantly cordial, and the fine points of halacha are disputed in a measured intellectual atmosphere. Not so the question of permitting artificial insemination. In cases where a woman is not able to conceive a child by her husband in the natural manner, it may at times be possible to impregnate her by means of a medical procedure whereby sperm is introduced into the uterus, right? Again, nowadays, this is like everyone knows this, but like back when it came out, it was, you know, absolute cutting edge. There are a number of potential halakhic pitfalls in this. The major questions of Jewish law which troubled the great authorities who addressed the question repeatedly in the course of more than 20 years of controversy are as follows. Number 1, is the child born of a married woman who became pregnant from someone other than her husband by means of a medical procedure considered a mamzer, right? So if you have a married woman, if she has a kid with another man, that kid in theory is a mamzer. So what if you do it with artificial insemination? Is the halacha the same? Who, as the product of an illicit relationship, is forbidden from ever marrying another Jew, right? So it's not good to be a mamzer. Number 2, even if the woman's husband could qualify as the sperm donor, may she be artificially inseminated at a time when she is a nida, right? Also, you can't have relations with your wife when she's a nida, but can you artificially inseminate her? Number 3, another question concerns which method of extracting sperm from the husband for the purpose of artificial insemination of his wife is sanctioned under Jewish law, right? Namely, hashchatat zera levatala. Can the man produce the sperm without actually doing it
with his wife. The authorities who dealt with these questions often did so with uncharacteristic emotion. Also, highly unusual is the frequency with which they returned to write on the topic again and again, qualifying and defining their previous opinions, at times almost retracting. After all is said and done, it is still difficult to assess how much weight in practical terms is to be given to their several pronouncements. So, for example, Rav Moshe Feinstein, who was the major authority to render a number of lenient responsa, at one point noted that in actual fact, I never told anyone to do it. Furthermore, he also writes that I never gave permission to any woman to undergo artificial insemination, for there is no halakhic imperative for her to bear children. It is only the man who has a mitzvah of be fruitful and multiply. Right. So, in other words, this is quoting Rav Moshe, how he sort of took it back, but he really did allow it at the end of the day. He also expressed the fear that it might cause deep antagonism between the man and his wife if she has children and he doesn't. Okay, etc., etc. So turn the page. Let's read from the top of the next page. Yet later, Rav Breish conceded that a child so conceived was acceptable. Okay, it is not hard to understand why the topic of artificial insemination did and continues to evoke such strong reaction on the part of laymen and scholars as well. Having children fulfills one of the most fundamental emotional needs which people have. The anxiety and anguish of couples who are unable to conceive cannot fail to move others whom we try to help them medically, psychologically, or with religious advice. If by some miracle of modern medicine it would be possible for a sterile couple to have a baby, there is a great deal of pressure upon the medical and religious community to make this feasible. Not only is there great emotional pressure and empathy for the pain which the unhappy couple experiences, but there is also a strong religious basis for finding a way to enable them to have children. The first mitzvah in the Torah is be fruitful and multiply, and if a way exists for an otherwise barren couple to fulfill this mitzvah, it might serve as an additional positive factor in arriving at a halachic decision. On the other hand, the purity of the Jewish family is an absolutely fundamental and important value in our religion. As Rashi notes in his commentary to the Torah, God himself attests to the purity of the Jewish families in the desert, attaching his name, so to speak, to each clan in order to verify that indeed the sons are the offspring of their fathers. The prohibition of adultery is included in the Ten Commandments, which the Jews received as a group standing at Mount Sinai. Regardless of any emotional pain and longing which a childless couple may suffer, conception of a child under circumstances which might be adulterous cannot in any way be sanctioned. Right, so as good as it might be, still can't do it if it's not okay. Thus, it is of overriding importance to determine the halakhic status of the act of artificial insemination, as well as the child produced by such a method. The vehemence of the controversy is not a feature of the rabbinic personalities involved, but rather of the crucial importance of their decisions, which would have repercussions for all generations. The artificial insemination controversy is also a testament to the dynamic nature of Jewish law and the brilliance of Torah scholars who are able to find in the eternal parameters of halakha solutions to the most complex problems raised by modern science and technology. Okay. What was the basis for Rav Feinstein's lenient opinions, and on what grounds was he challenged? In his earliest response on the subject, Rav Feinstein was asked about the status of a woman who had undergone artificial insemination. Was she considered an adulteress? This is not a simple problem, which is that the Torah forbids, when it outlaws adultery, the physical act of a union of a woman with a man other than her husband, or any union of his sperm and her egg, no matter how or where. So, right, what is it that the Torah prohibits? Is it just the physical act, or is it the biological act? Right, Rav Feinstein's position on this crucial point is unequivocal. He maintains that the relationship of adultery arises only when there is a forbidden physical union between a woman and another man. In the absence of a sexual relationship, the child which the married woman bears by means of artificial insemination is wholly legitimate in the eyes of Jewish law. So in other words, so let's spell this out for a second. If you have a Jewish woman who's married to a Jewish man, if she would have relations with another Jewish man and they would produce a child, that would be what we call a mamzer. If she would receive the sperm from this other Jewish man through artificial insemination, that child would be totally halakhically okay because the physical act is what's prohibited, and that's what creates the mamzer and not the biological transference of the sperm. Not only that, but the husband may continue to live with his wife, something a man may not do if his wife had an adulterous relationship. Okay, next paragraph. Feinstein relies on a precedent established by Rabbi Peretz and cited by the Taz in the 17th century, as well as in the fact that the Gemara often quotes with great respect the teachings of Ben Sira. Okay, let's skip this part. Go to the bottom paragraph in like this section. Based on this, Rav Feinstein reaches an important conclusion. If there is no forbidden sexual act, the child is quite acceptable according to Jewish law. He concludes that the only reason the Taz said a woman should not sleep in a bed previously occupied by another man is that if she were to become pregnant this way, her child might later unwittingly marry a sibling unaware that he is not really the child of his legal father. So in other words, there's this case of can you sleep in the same man can a woman who's married sleep in the same bed as another man, and there's a concern that maybe she'll be inseminated. It's not such a case that we could understand with our modern science, but that is the case, and So that's what he's talking about. Therefore, Rav Feinstein cautions that a child conceived by artificial insemination might have to be careful not to marry another child of the same sperm donor, because then, right, without knowing it, you could end up marrying your sibling. However, this consideration poses no problem for Rav Feinstein for two reasons. Obviously, the majority of girls will not be in the category of possible sisters. Moreover, the overwhelming majority of sperm donors are likely to be non-Jews, whose children, according to Jewish law, would not be considered siblings to the child in question. We are entitled to rely on the majority rule, and therefore to permit the child to marry any other Jew. Okay. Let's turn the page, and we'll go to the top of the next page. The reaction. So the reaction to these halakhic statements was vehement and heated. Although at times the grounds for condemnation were not explicated, so Rav Breish, while calling the act abominable, forbidden, disgusting, and grounds for divorcing a woman against her will, nevertheless himself writes that if, after all, a child was born in this manner, and we have to determine if it is a mamzer or not, since we have no clear-cut decision from our earliest rabbis on this except for Rabbeinu Peres, the child is acceptable, and similarly we have no grounds for declaring the woman forbidden to her husband. So that was the great opinion and the great perspective of Rav Moshe Feinstein. Now, okay, we're going to turn three pages, okay? One, two, and then on the third page. That's the, where it says the Satmar Rebbe is on top. Anyone with me? Okay, if you're on this page, you've gone too far, turn back. Okay. The Satmar Rebbe's position stands in stark contrast to that of Rav Feinstein. The Rebbe holds that the issue of a woman and a man who is not her husband is considered a mamzer. It is not the act alone which is forbidden, but the biological union of egg and sperm, no matter how accomplished. Even absent any forbidden sexual contact or union, if a woman becomes pregnant from a man other than a husband, her child is a mamzer, forbidden to be accepted by other Jews. So this was the great controversy that was between Rav Moshe and the Satmar Rebbe. As you might be aware, the way Hasidim work is a little bit different than our modern Orthodox world. If the Rebbe in your sect says something, you follow that Rebbe at all costs. That's why you ended up having a chazan who wrote this terrible book against Rav Moshe, that, again, as we said, that book was burned, because people who were not Satmar Hasidim did not know how you could say such a thing. There's a famous story also of the Satmar Rebbe sending two Hasidim to talk to Rav Moshe and try to convince him to change his mind, which was a fascinating thing in general. But the Satmar Rebbe told the Hasidim, don't bring up Torah. If you bring up anything regarding to the Torah, then he's going to destroy you. What did they do? They went there, they were trying to convince him, maybe you shouldn't have written this, maybe you shouldn't allow it, and they decided to bring up some Torah. Moshe destroyed them, they walked out embarrassed, and that was the end of that. So this was the great machlokas that existed between these two. Again, speaking to the greatness of who Moshe Feinstein was as a posik, it was very easy for a rabbi to get up and say that this is prohibited. However, there would be a lot of couples who would not be able to have children nowadays if in the Orthodox world, if Moshe would not have allowed this, and in his greatness, he was able to matir it and say that it was okay. Again, are there limitations to the rule? Should you pass him anything from what we just said? Absolutely not. But he did allow it, and again, that speaks to the greatness of who he was. Okay, and on March 23rd, 1986, Rav Moshe, at the age of 91, passed away, and he is buried on Har Menuchot in Israel. Just take a look at source number 9 real quickly, where we there's a little paragraph on the end of Rav Moshe's life in the final day or so. It says, on the following Sunday night, the eve of Tainus Esther 5746, a call was sounded to the Hatzalah Emergency Rescue Squad. Rabbi Moshe Feinstein had to be rushed to the hospital immediately. As the ambulance was speeding to the hospital, he felt his strength waning. He said, Ich hab mehr nicht, kein Koach, I have no more strength. Those were his last words. How much strength that he had for the last several years? Very little. But whatever strength was left in him was devoted to Hashem, to Torah, and to Klal Yisrael. As long as he had strength, any strength, his service continued. He would not stop working at his full capacity as he had for 91 years, and then he had no more strength. In the base medrash of the yeshiva of Staten Island, boys and young men were fervently reciting to him, imploring to Hashem to spare him. At 9:50 p.m., the light fixture over his seat near the Aron Kodosh flickered and went out. Then it glowed for a moment and went out again. Rav Moshe was gone, and then it was dark. Right? This is something only an art school biography can actually write. But this is what they say. And this is a really art school thing to say. It has been pointed out that the 5,746th verse in the Torah, right, it was the year 5746, it reads, and it came to pass after Moshe had finished writing down the words of the Torah in a book to the very end. Appropriate words for the Gadol Hador, who was named after Moshe Rabbeinu, who passed away in the year 5746. Right, there's a really interesting New York Times article that we're not going to read right now, just I'm concerned about time over here, but it's an article that talks about his funeral, how there are so many thousands and thousands of individuals who attended his funeral. One line I will point out Shed, I guess, in the middle. It's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 7 paragraphs down on page 17. Just a quick quote that was said at his funeral. "We are all orphans and we have no father," said Rabbi Chaim Stein, head of the Tel Zvi Yeshiva in Cleveland, expressing his the sorrow heard in eulogy after eulogy. Right? How horrible it was that the world lost Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, who was so great in so many ways, not only just in his Torah, but also and his absolute kindness and midos that he shared with the world. On page number 19 is source number 11, and I thank Rabbi Volk for pointing this out of Shal Shivas a couple of weeks ago. This is the Matseva, the tombstone of Moshe Feinstein. It has this cute like acronym to his name. At the top it says Maran HaGaon HaGadol, right? That spells out, that's for Mem. Shin Sar HaTorah V'Hayira. Hai Chasir V'Hai Anav, right? So that talks about his greatness, and that spells out his name in an acrostic. And then it says, Rabban Shel Kol Yisrael. He was the rabbi of all the Jewish people. The reason why he was called the rabbi of all the Jewish people is because, as we've spoken of for the last hour, there was no one who clearly encompassed the greatness of Moshe Feinstein, not just in the halachic decisions, but also in his ability to love every single Jew and care about every single Jew, such that even impacted his halacha, that he was able to say that we need leniency sometimes for the Jewish nation to be able to continue to perpetuate the traditions of Orthodox Judaism and to continue to live a Jewish life. And that is the person that Rav Moshe was, just this individual who was always not only spreading halacha and teaching Torah, but also spreading absolute kindness and love for every single Jew.